calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live all across the United States of America. There you go, David. Thank you very much. Today, George W. Bush gave a speech at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, before, as usual, a closed-to-the-public, hand-picked audience of folks who, either by job description or by inclination, had to or wanted to applaud him at every opportunity. Our bubble boy president, once again, in the bubble. And in his speech, he made a series of points. Number one, he said that the people that we're fighting against, frankly, I think the most revealing part of the entire speech. And this comment that I'm gonna share with you in just a moment. And frankly, I also doubt that the mainstream media is going to pick up on it at all. But I felt that this, you know, just looking at this, listening to this, getting a sense of, you know, what Bush is saying, how he's saying it, and why he's saying it, it really brought home to me this comment that Seymour Hersh made the other day, that George W. Bush is being basically kept in a closet, wrong metaphor, but, you know, whatever, shunted off to the side and being fed religious platitudes by his advisors. He's being told by people like Cheney and Wolfowitz and Feith and Rumsfeld and whatnot that, yes, God did select him. He has a great and noble destiny. It's his destiny to be in the White House. Therefore, anything he says or does is the right thing and all that sort of thing. Anyhow, here's the statement he made. He said that the people that were fighting in Iraq have declared, quote, a war against humanity, end quote. Now, think about that for a minute. Even Adolf Hitler didn't declare a war against humanity. You could say that what he did was inhuman or inhumane. I mean, you know, you could say, obviously. I mean, you know, it was beyond that. It was beyond despicable. But Hitler suggested that he was trying to create a thousand years of peace in Europe, and that the way to do it was to do what he was doing. You know, he was wrong, he was nuts, he was a tyrant, he was a dictator, he was a mass murderer. But even Hitler never declared a war against humanity. Pol Pot killed 2 million of his own people in Cambodia. He reset the calendar to the year zero, just like the French did during the French Revolution. And you know, reset the calendar. They did in the French Revolution. They did away with Christianity. They created their own religion. They changed the names of the months. Pol Pot did the same thing. They were trying to do essentially what the Catholics did 2,005 years ago in resetting history, causing a great forgetting, to use Dan Quinn's phrase, of everything prior to that point in time, to say this is the beginning of history. But even Pol Pot did not declare a war against humanity. He declared he killed anybody who wore eyeglasses to start out with in Cambodia, because that was evidence that the people were literate. And then it went down from there. So you have to ask yourself the question, who would declare a war against humanity if we're all human? And the answer is metaphysical. The only entities that would declare a war against humanity are demons. Satan, the devil, demons, non-human entities would declare a war against humanity. Space aliens might declare a war against humanity. The lizard people, if you believe in David Ecke's, would declare war against humanity, or could. But humans don't declare war against humanity. And that's why I think this was such a revealing statement when he said that a war against humanity, either this means that George Bush believes that he is fighting a crusade, a holy war, and that the people that he is fighting against are demon-possessed and are fighting a war against humanity, that this really and truly is the end time situation, scenario, that we're right on the edge of the Battle of Armageddon and the demons have taken over human bodies and have declared a war against humanity. Either he believes that, or he is cravenly using the rhetoric of political, of religious extremism albeit the Christian version of religious extremism, but nonetheless, the rhetoric of religious extremism to justify military action. And, you know, you look back in history at the people who have done that, and it has never turned out well. So some of the points to George Bush. Number one, he declared a war against humanity. Number two, it took him a total, from the time he began speaking until he mentioned 9/11, total 27 seconds. 27 seconds to mention 9/11. He went into a long rap about the Sunnis and the Shia without pointing out that if Iraq does not end up as a secular democracy, which he didn't get into, if it doesn't end up as a secular democracy, but it ends up as Shia-dominated, and you have this constitution that sets up a Supreme Court where the theocrats can veto any laws that are not consistent with Islam, what you have is the same system of government that exists in Iran, which is Shia. In other words, Iran wins. He suggested that foreigners were responsible for most of the what he called terror in Iraq. He tried to reframe the insurgents. Now, an insurgency is when people within a nation rise up to fight either against their own government or against people who have occupied that nation. The American Revolution was an insurgency. We fought off the British, and we fought off not an insignificant portion, perhaps as many as a third of the people living in North America who called themselves citizens of British America in that insurgency. Now, any attempt to draw a parallel, obviously, between what's going on in Iraq and what happened in the United States in 1776 is wildly imperfect. But to get to that specific point of are these terrorists or are they insurgents? Let's not forget that the third George to rule the United Kingdom, King George III, referred to George Washington, the first George to rule the United States, as a terrorist. And now the third George to rule the United States is using the same rhetoric that the third George who ruled England used against us. He's using against Iraq. He's saying that they're terrorists. And he suggested that most of the terrorism was the responsibility of foreigners, when in fact all the reports, including his own government's reports, indicate that foreign fighters in Iraq are few and far between. That what's going on is, by and large, that we have become the irritant, as Jack Murtha pointed out. As King Abdullah points out, as Hosni Mubarak of Egypt points out, King Abdullah of Jordan points out, Abdullah II, that we have become the irritant. We are viewed as the occupiers. And so what you have is not a terrorist attack or an external attack. What you have is an insurgency, a homegrown insurgency. People saying, get out of our country. It's what the Vietnamese said to the French. It's what the Vietnamese said to us. And it is now what the Iraqis are saying to us. And he kept referring to these terrorists throughout his speech. It's not the terrorists that are the problem. Yes, there are some terrorists in Iraq now. There weren't before we showed up. I mean, there might have been one guy, right, who was there recuperating from something. And, you know, whether or not Saddam even knew about it, one guy. I mean, pick a Middle Eastern country. Pick a country in the world where you can't find one terrorist. There might have been one guy there. But by and large, Saddam Hussein had that situation under control. He wanted to have nothing to do with religious extremists. Nothing whatsoever to do with them, be they Sunni or be they Shia. So Bush, you know, trying to say it's foreigners responsible for most of this. Sorry, it's not. He tried again in his 27 seconds into his speech, tied it to 9/11. He said they share the philosophy of the people who attacked us on 9/11. In a way, yeah. Osama bin Laden back in 1997, 1998 said to us unambiguously, loudly, it was reprinted in the New York Times, the reason that he was attacking the United States was because we had our troops on holy Saudi soil. We had men drinking alcohol and shaving the hair off their face, and we had women showing their elbows and driving on and thus defiling Saudi soil. the holiest site in all of Islam, the keeper of Mecca and Medina, and that was absolutely unacceptable. They were put there in 1991 by George Bush's father. And Osama bin Laden said, if you don't pull those soldiers out, I'm going to start attacking you. And he did, over and over and over again. And finally, a few months ago, George W. Bush pulled those soldiers out of Saudi Arabia. Osama got what he wanted. So you could say, yeah, there is some similarity in that Osama said he wanted us out of Saudi Arabia, and the Iraqis are saying they wanted us out of Iraq. But I'd say that's where the parallel ends. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, here for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Working together like spokes inside a wheel, they keep this country turning around. Hello, Kansas, sweet little farmer, let me thank you for your time. You are the 40-hour week for living, just to send it all down the line.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes. There you go. Hello, America. Thank you for making this a great nation. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Eco Wine, the organic wine company. 1-888-ECO-WINE, ECOWINE, 1-888-ECOWINE. Great gifts for the holidays there. The Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Just a quick review. George Bush, the things that George Bush didn't tell you in his speech today on Iraq, and that you won't hear from the talking heads. In fact, by and large, what you hear from the talking heads is more of the same, more 9/11, World War II, quack, 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 quack. What he didn't tell you is that approximately 100 attacks a day are happening on coalition forces. This is an all-time high. October, according to the Pentagon, 100 attacks a day average, compared to September, 85 to 90 average. Almost half of all of these attacks involve homemade bombs. Because we failed to secure the high explosives munitions dumps in Iraq after the successful invasion of that country, there is enough high explosives floating around that country right now for them to be manufacturing bombs for over 400 years at the current rate of usage. Because we didn't do anything about it. We simply let them loot the munitions dumps while we were securing the oil fields, the oil pipelines, and the Ministry of Oil. One of the deadliest attacks in Iraq has occurred just in the last 10 days. Over 100 people were killed Friday in one of the deadliest attacks in Baghdad, actually. The unemployment rate in Iraq is at 40%. The oil production is below pre-war levels. The water, electricity, and health networks. So somebody sent me an email yesterday saying, you know, how do I reply to this? It was an email he got from some right-wing friend saying, did you know that there's over 220 schools open? There's five colleges open. The water is supplied to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it had all these wonderful sounding statistics until you compare them to how things were before we started bombing. None of this stuff is up to where it was when we invaded the country. And we've spent billions of dollars so-called rebuilding. And where is it going? It seems to be going into the pockets of Halliburton and other Bush-affiliated contractors, but we're not seeing much result for it. As of November 28, 2005, at least 2,107 U.S. troops had died, over 15,500 wounded. You did not hear George Bush talk about that. About 94% of all U.S. fatalities have occurred since he declared mission accomplished on May 1st of 2003. You didn't hear him talk about that. About 60% of all U.S. fatalities have occurred after the transfer of sovereignty back in June 28th of 2004. You didn't hear him talk about that. That's 1,246 troops have died since we said, okay, everything's fine. We transferred sovereignty over to the Iraqis. Right. See, I tell you, what's going on here is that Bush is preparing to do what Richard Nixon was advised to do by, I believe it was Henry Kissinger, the famous comment. May have been somebody else. Perhaps somebody will refresh my memory on this. This was back in the 70s. Somebody said to Nixon, why don't you just declare victory and go home? And that's what Bush is going to do. It's what he has to do if his party's going to survive. Although there are some who are suggesting he's not going to do that, that he believes that God's ordained him to fight this holy war, this crusade, and that, you know, he's the reincarnation of Pope Pius or something. It's incredible. Over 225 foreigners have been kidnapped by insurgents in Iraq. Over $250 billion of American money has been spent on Iraq. Reconstruction has been spotty. The number of troops trained, uncertain. And this is the thing. Oh, you know, why is it taking us 3 years to build an army? The fact of the matter is, if people really believe that their country is under attack, you can't stop them from building an army. They will do it even without any leadership. And by the way, that's what's going on. It's called the insurgency. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. John in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
How's it going today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, we can always be better.
There you go.
I'm sure that the Iraqis want to get us out of there so they can form their own form of government, and I'm sure it'll be a theocracy, you know, where if one of the religious leaders decides that they don't like a law, they'll just change it, you know.
It has already happened. There are large parts of Iraq now where if men cut their beards, they get executed, where alcohol vendors are put to death, women are being gang raped for not being virgins, honor killings are happening. Iraq is already sliding into theocracy right now as we speak.
The unfortunate part about that is that's kind of what Bush wants to do here.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court in his own pocket.
There you go.
Okay, we don't like this law. Okay, let's change it.
There you go. Harlan, you're absolutely right, John. Harlan in Los Angeles, a little less than a minute left. Quick comment.
Yeah, hello, Tom. I just want to make a quick point, which is everybody talks about terrorism as if it's unexpected. But I want to point out that when the United States and the Soviets were engaged in the Cold War, we had a defined enemy that could meet us on the battlefield tank for tank. You take away the Soviet Union, we still have enemies in the world. It's naive to expect that we don't. But they don't have the mechanized forces to meet us in the classic sense of a battlefield, so they're going to fight us any way they can.
You're absolutely right, Harlan, and that's the bottom line. It really is the bottom line. By the way, we're going to do a contest here real quickly. We're going to give away a copy of my book, We the People Call to Take Back America, and an Impeach Bush button to the sixth caller with the correct answer to the following question. Right now, the question is, how long did it take President Bush to bring up 9/11 in his speech on Iraq this morning? So the sixth caller with the right answer, with the correct answer, will win a copy of my book, We the People, A Call to Take Back in America, and an Impeach Bush button. The telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. The sixth caller with the correct answer wins the book and the button. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
You got to fight for your rights. You can't bury your head in the sand.
There you go. Welcome back. By the way, we have a winner in our progressive pop quiz.
You got to fight for your rights.
And congratulations, Kevin Gallagher of Marysville, Washington. Yes, indeed, Kevin. Congratulations. Kevin wins a copy of my book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America, a 200-page illustrated history of America, and an Impeach Bush button that you can proudly wear. He knew that the answer to the question, how long did it take President Bush to bring up 9/11 in his speech on Iraq this morning, was 27 seconds. 27 seconds. Pretty amazing. Anyhow, congratulations to you, Kevin, and thanks for participating in our Progressive Pop Quiz today. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 1-866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, Trey in Raleigh, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Trey, what's on your mind today?
I want to talk about the businesses in Iraq. And I think that's what Bush pretty much means when he says stay the course in Iraq. Well, this is one thing I want to talk about. I also want to talk about yesterday when the media was bringing up, talking about Bush said God told him to do this. But anyway, the businesses in Iraq, I think that's what Bush means by stay the course. And as long as his business friends can make a profit off of Iraq, they're going to stay there.
Oh, they're making a fortune. They're making an absolute bloody fortune. And it's not just that, Trey. It's they are trying to prove that their form of economics works. Yesterday on my local program here in Portland, I had on David Walker, the Comptroller General of the currency for the United States, the head guy for our currency. And I asked him the question. I said, you know, Reagan came in with this idea of supply-side economics, that if you give tax breaks to wealthy people, it'll trickle down. And it didn't work for Reagan. It doesn't seem to be working for Bush. Is the idea of supply-side economics discredited? And he said, yeah, it's discredited. And And but the Bushies are trying to recredit it. You know, they're trying to say, no, this utopian, libertarian, pseudo-conservative view of economics where the corporations run everything, government is very small, we the people play no role in our economic destiny. We can vote for elected officials, but they have no power. You do away with your government agencies and things like that, so you have no way to protect yourself. That's how it should be. And that nasty socialism where you've got strong unions and universal health care that we imposed on Germany and Japan after World War II, when Truman, said, hey, I can't get it through here in the United States, but I'll show you that it works. And he rewrote the constitutions of Germany and Japan to include those things. The Bushies wanted to say, we'll prove to you that Iraq is going to be a workers' paradise. It's going to be an absolute wonderful place because we're going to do away with all that. We'll ban unions. We'll allow corporations to do anything they want. Total free trade. No barriers. No borders. Nothing. And it's a disaster.
It's a disaster. That's one of the problems with this. I think that's the main problem in Iraq. That's when John Edwards was talking about his vote in Iraq. He laid out 3 points. The first point he said was that we need to remove the imperialistic face from the occupation by first removing U.S. contractors.
Yeah.
And putting the Iraqis back to work to rebuild their own country.
John Edwards said that?
Yeah, that was in the I Was Wrong article that he wrote.
Oh, that's amazing. Somehow that flew right by me. I am another reason why I think he should be president of the United States. Okay. And the other point you're going to make.
Yeah, about George Bush, it seems like every time he makes a bunch of excuses, and every time the excuses get disproven, then he blames it on God by saying God told him to do something.
Yeah, well, he doesn't tell us that. He told the Quakers that, and he told the Prime Minister of the PLO or the Palestinian State that Abbas.
Because he was saying that the reason things were going bad in Iraq was because they didn't have enough money. They got enough money. Then it was going bad because he had people coming from outside. Then that was just disproven. Then it was we were going to stay the course until the Iraqis could take care of themselves and the government. Could run, then the government told him to get out, and then he came up with, God.
Yeah, it is always something new. Trey, you make a good point. I thank you for calling and sharing it with us. Very well said. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, you heard Bush's speech this morning?
Right. Yeah, and you gave a list of what he did not say. I have a couple more.
Okay.
He did absurdly try to compare Iraq to World War II, which is a joke and shameless, but what he did not say is that in World War II, it was the Republicans in Congress that opposed World War II.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I had intended yesterday, when I went home and I forgot to do it, to dig out my copy of Rex Stout's book, The Illustrious Dunderheads, published in 48 or 49, in Rex Stout, the guy who created the Nero Wolfe character. And at the time this was published, probably the most famous author in America, contemporary author. And what it was is a collection of speeches on the floor of the House and Senate by Republicans.
Right.
Arguing against, this is all pre Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. arguing against the United States entering into World War II and talking about how Roosevelt was going to try and get us into World War II in order to solidify his own political power and for his own political purposes and, nefarious political purposes, because that Hitler guy, he's not that bad and we should just be leaving him alone, and this is a German problem or a European problem. And like you say, it was all, it wasn't all Republicans, but it was, there were a few Joe Liebermans in there as well, but it was almost all Republicans.
Well, even Bob Dole always used to refer to those democratic wars of World War II. Right?
Yeah, he called them the Democrat Wars,
right.
Yes. World War I, World War II.
Right,
yeah.
And Bush also did mention that Osama bin Laden is the link to 9/11.
Well.
And it's blasphemous for Bush to try to invoke World War II and get some of that FDR magic to rub off on him. They keep trying that.
Oh, I know. And he's not going to stop, I guarantee you.
And we shouldn't say, like you said, that we liberals imposed socialism on Europe. Actually, we extended democracy in the workplace in all facets. They call it socialism, but it's actually democracy and a voice in the workplace.
You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
A labor union is a democratic institution. It has members. They elect
right.
leaders. They make decisions by consensus or majority.
Americans don't understand the word socialism. They interpret that as state control, no freedom. That's why.
Well, it's because Karl Marx used it, and because the Soviet Union
right.
used it. Union of Soviet
Socialists. Use their language.
Yeah, I agree. well said, Tom. Good point, and thank you for making it. You keep me straight here. James in Ocala, Florida. Hey, James.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I am great. What's up?
Oh, that's good to hear. Yeah, I got one quick point, if I may. You know, as a former misled conservative and now an enlightened liberal, I have been on both sides as a fence. And some speech, and I listen to liberal talk radio all the time, including yourself. I think you're probably the best on the radio, if I may say.
Thank you.
But there's a lot of attention being made to the connection between the church, per se, organized religion, and the Republican Party. We all know that they're fixated on one another, and that there's a gridlock amongst a sizable number of voters in this country, unfortunately, tying in those two and thinking that anybody who's outside those two frameworks is not Christian.
Yeah.
You know? And but the thing is that
Jimmy Carter's taking a whack at that right now, by the way, you know.
Well, that's a good thing. I've been watching him. I watched him on Larry King, and that's a really good thing. But the thing is that if we can just point out to these people how, if it could be shown, because their allegiance truly, I think, probably is number one to Christ's words, okay, and what Christ talked about. If we could show them that the Republican Party does not represent Christian values, then we might make some headway. And if I could just leave one thing, there's so many. You know, Christ was the original liberal. One of the many things is that if you listen to the dialogue of conservatives and righties and the Republican Party, they're all and the Falwells and Robertsons of the world. These people in their speech, the poor, are considered by. Time after time after time, you listen to them when they talk about the poor, and they don't talk about them very much. But when they do talk about the poor are a liability.
Or they represent the poor as people who have moral failings.
Yes, yes. So the poor people.
I mean,
this is
where I say, you know,
crimes.
Yeah, these guys are.
They're a burden on society and economically, socially.
Yeah, and the one phrase about the poor that they like to quote from Jesus is, "The poor you will have with you always," which is terribly out of context because it had to do with, you know, washing his feet and, you know, shouldn't we take this money out and give it to the poor? And he was really talking about, you know, what you're doing right now is really symbolic and important. And you know, but over and over again, he was talking about the poor. I mean, it was just hundreds
of
times.
Absolutely. What, 70% of what Christ was talking about was about the poor?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if we... If it could be just shown these people's minds, if they could be
well, and good point, James, and thank you for making it. And it goes just beyond that as well. In Judaism, there's this notion of tikkun lalam, the whole idea that we are born into this world with an obligation to heal the world by virtue of the fact that we are born into it. And that, you know, just is foundational to Judaism. The idea of caring for the poor is foundational to Islam. You find it distorted over the years by the caste system, but certainly, you know, a foundational concept in Hinduism. Buddhism is all, I mean, you know, it's just, name a major world religion, and you find that they are all antithetical to the principles that the Republicans have been espousing. And, you know, Pope John Paul II, taking on George Bush and taking on the Republicans and these kinds of things. So, you know, this is... you know, good point you make, and I think it really needs to be expanded. Jimmy Carter out there saying essentially hate is not an American value. Hate is not, and that the whole idea of not just religion but of spirituality having been hijacked by the Republicans for just the crassest and most craven of political exploitation in the context of you know, oh, well, we're more religious than you are, is really a horrific thing. It is the exact thing that Jesus was so upset about in the temple, and you know, no shortage of prophets in the Old Testament of Jewish prophets talking about this exact same thing, what the Republicans are up to. Go back and read, you know, Jeremiah's rant about, you know, I gave you my sheep and look what you've done with them. I mean, this is anyhow, don't get me started on that. I'll sound like a preacher. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
But if you do right, Jimmy, baby, I'll the right to you too. Got to do under this. I can have them. Let me have them. Do unto you.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Somehow I think that we wouldn't want somebody dropping white phosphorus on our cities. It just, you know, it just seems logical. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Brian in Alberta, Canada on the line. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Great to talk to you, Tom.
Well, thanks for being here.
Sorry I missed out on the book.
Okay. There'll be another opportunity. What's up?
Yeah. The States has always been like a big brother to Canada. But now I'm hiding my head in shame because my big brother's gone crazy.
Mm. As some of us. Not all of us.
No, I know. But to sit there and watch what he's doing, and it goes against everything that we've fought so hard for over the last two centuries, right?
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Although, Brian, in Canada, you are fighting a rearguard action against conservatives in your own country, are you not?
Definitely, definitely we are. And like two nights ago, our minority government was voted down on non-confidence, and now we're going to mire through another. We've got a strong movement from the Alliance Party that's fighting to. They have some good ideas, but they're back to standing on the soapbox, beating the Christian drum that. They know what's right for us and what's wrong for us.
Yeah, what's so interesting to me is that Reagan and Thatcher, you know, came to power roughly the same time, and with this philosophy of trickle-down economics, supply-side economics, and corporatism, you know, just turn everything over to the corporations and privatize all the government functions. And it has been so badly discredited. I mean, all anybody has to do is look at the numbers here in the United States, at our debt, at our national debt, at our annual budget deficits, at our trade imbalances, and you can see it's a disaster. You can see the same thing in England. Look at the National Rail Service, for example, the National Health Service. What's, you know, the consequence of these economic policies? And yet, there are still countries around the world who are saying, gee, maybe we should do that. And Canada has a lot of folks, and there are a lot of folks in your country saying, gee, maybe we should become more like America.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's tragic.
And we've already got the lower half paying the majority of the taxes, and they've proven here that the trickle-down effect does not work.
Yeah, no, and we've proven it here, too. Brian, was that the point you wanted to make?
No, that's it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Scott in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I think it's interesting that whenever we start talking about American casualties, that Secretary Rumsfeld lets us know that there's only a handful of insurgents that's doing this. And now, yeah, I kind of think that, you know, American military is the finest trained on the planet. So either it's more than a handful, or these guys are not as well trained as I think they are.
Well, there's another factor here, Scott, that I think a lot of people miss completely, and that is that you cannot have in a country a popular insurgency. You cannot have even a small insurgency without the popular support of the people. In other words,
right.
if in the United States. And in fact, we saw this. We saw this in the United States back in the 70s. There were small groups that popped up, the Symbionese Liberation Army and whatnot. And, you know, and some were African American, some were white, some, you know, whatever, you know, the
right.
Groups popping up. And even now there's, you know, little remnants of white supremacists and whatnot. They can't, if any of those groups were to launch I mean, we kind of tolerate them because of free speech, but if any of them were to launch an actual war against the government of the United States, you know, where they started blowing up police stations and shooting people, the other Americans around them would turn them in. They wouldn't be able to survive. You have to have the support of at least half of the civilian population in order to have the hiding places to mount an insurgency. So the fact of an insurgency demonstrates that you've lost the average person.
Right.
Just the fact that the insurgency is there and is viable demonstrates that it doesn't matter whether you got 50 insurgents or 5,000. If the people didn't support it, they would be turning these folks in, and they're not.
Yeah, I agree 100%. You know, I think also interesting that before we invaded Iraq, you know, President gave Saddam, who is this, you know, tyrant and evil man, he said, well, I'll tell you what, you got 48 hours to relocate to another place.
Yeah. And
if you relocate, you know, we won't invade your country.
No, we'll just negotiate with a new country and take their oil. Scott, thanks for the call. Perry in Bowling Green. We just have a half a minute left or so. Hey, Perry, what's up?
Yeah, I just think the right wingers need to understand that when Jesus found the poor and the that was about to be stoned, that he said the one with no sin or least sin cast the first stone, and they all bowed their heads there.
Yeah.
Right. They pick and choose what they want to understand about the Bible, and that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, we need a revival of Christianity and of Judaism, and I'd say right across the board, all of the religions represented in the United States. And frankly, thank you, Perry, for your comments. And frankly, the secular folks, the non-religious folks. Secular does not mean non-religious; it means a government of, by, and for the people. But you know, the atheists and agnostics, the humanists, the people who believe, you know, it's just basic morality. We need to start speaking out and saying, you know, what the Bushies are doing. And what the Republicans are doing, I mean, this goes way beyond George Bush. What the Republican Party has done is they've created an unholy alliance with theocrats, with right-wing theocrats like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, who do not represent the fine and noble and extraordinary traditions of Judaism and Christianity, which they claim to represent. They do not represent it in any way. In fact, they are misrepresenting it and smearing it. I mean, it's tragic, and we must... I think, you know, people of faith and people of morality in the United States need to be speaking out. That's what I'm so proud of Jimmy Carter. He's written this new book about this, and he's running around speaking out about it. And, you know, good on him. God bless him. It's just great. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. We're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Or maybe it would be better to say, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. That's a little better slogan. 57 minutes past the hour.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the No Boring Zone, the Tom Hartman Program, your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Alec DeBrow is with us. He is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org, their website, ILCAonline.org. Hey, Alec.
Hey, Tom. The No Boring Zone, huh? That's a pretty high bar. I'll try to jump over it, but this is labor. I might even have a statistic in here.
Actually, Alec, you are rarely boring, which is why I keep inviting you back.
Well,
listen, let's have a little bit of a, you know, let's mix it up here a little bit. You pick on Democrats, I'll pick on labor unions. How's that?
It makes sense to me.
Okay, you go first.
Okay. Let's go back. Let's talk about socially progressive anti-union people in positions of authority.
How about socially progressive anti-union Democrats?
Even those.
Yeah, because you know, I want you to pick on Democrats so I can pick on unions.
Okay. Democrats
so,
it is.
So
all
go
right.
For it.
The appearance of people who support progressive causes and then fight and even despise unions. And here's an example. I read it in a union paper that Oregon AFL-CIO president Tim Nesbitt had been talking to some high-tech millionaires, and they were thanking him for the union support, helping to win an election for a Democrat, you know, giving money, phone banks, walking precincts. So Nesbitt asked, why weren't they union? They said, oh, our workers don't need it.
Right.
We pay well.
Right.
The hubris of these guys who decide, you know, well, you know, we'll make a decision for them. They don't need it. Let me give you another one here. David Needleman, he's the CEO of JetBlue. I don't know if your community is served by JetBlue.
It is,
one of the
actually.
Startup airlines.
Yeah, they just started flying into Portland. I've flown on JetBlue, in fact.
Very comfortable, very hip, very nice. David Needleman's big-time Democratic contributor.
And they're very non-union.
They are completely non-union, and here's what he says to the San Francisco Chronicle last year. Would you resist a labor organizing effort at JetBlue? Answer, we would, he said. He admits that in the past there were some bad companies and perhaps a need for unions, but we're not one of those companies. We don't do that to our people. He says, we don't want a third party who may or may not have our best interests in mind. They're trying to equalize us and take away our competitive advantage. In other words, we want to keep our wages low.
Well, it's not even that, I think, Alec. It's because, for example, Southwest Airlines is the most profitable airline in the United States and has been for over a decade, and it's also the most heavily unionized airline in the United States.
Right.
And which absolutely gives the lie to the meme, the thought virus that's out there that is being flogged by the right-wing business press virtually every day, that the unions are somehow behind the demise of the various airlines. And so what Needleman is saying, in my opinion, is not so much necessarily that he wants to keep wages down, because he actually pays pretty decent wages, at least that's my understanding, but that he doesn't believe in democracy in the workplace.
Right.
Because
that's
what a union is. It's democracy in the workplace. He doesn't want to share power with his employees.
Yes,
and
it is about power. It is, but he wants, but I also do believe that the final say on wages must be his, is what he's also
sure.
saying.
You
know, when they talk about flexibility and competitiveness, that's more
Those
work
code
for
words.
Less money, essentially.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yes, it is about power, and it's very troubling, because here's the most problematic case is the one of Starbucks. And my wife, Kim Fellner, and I did considerable research into Starbucks, and we met the founder, Howard Schultz, a few times. And Schultz is way out in front of so many companies on health care. He gives health care to part-timers. He's, in fact, begun lobbying Congress for national health care. He's joining with other people.
He's a relatively progressive guy, and it's a startlingly progressive company. I, here in Portland, doing the local show one morning, I made a disparaging remark about Starbucks, and I started, because we have local coffee companies competing with them, and all
right.
of a sudden I got, you know, just local progressives calling me up and taking me to task. I had no idea. You know.
Yeah, it's one of these things that, you know, I have a lot of respect for the guy, but on the subject of unions, he's just unreachable.
Yeah.
Recently, in New York, the IWW, the old Industrial Workers of the World.
The Wobblies.
The Wobblies, which is sort of a union, it's sort of a movement organization, tried organizing a couple of Starbucks stores. And Schultz reacted as if the entire AFL-CIO had invaded his stores. He sent out a phone message to all the workers in the New York area, telling them, he called the news very disappointing and disturbing. He was deeply saddened. He said, we deliberately created a great work environment and treated everyone with dignity and respect. You know, but the problem is, a workplace doesn't have to be cruel and despicable for workers to want some independent power. And you were saying it yourself. I mean, this is about power. And it's sort of like a parent saying, you know, I've given you everything, now you want to go off on your own. It's just not right.
Yeah.
Well, it, you know.
It is right. It is the American tradition.
It is the American tradition.
Yeah.
It's legally right. It's morally right. But these are the people who have the power. And
so we need to. So the bottom line here of what you're saying, Alec, is that it's time for us to start holding progressive business people to the standard of, or to the ideal, that part of being a progressive means supporting unions, and supporting unions means supporting unions in your own workplace. I mean, I find it strange that, you know, my morning show here is on a Clear Channel station, which people don't think of as a progressive company.
Yeah.
It's a union shop.
Yep.
I'm a member of AFTRA, and it's a union shop in this right wing conservative company, and yet you've got these progressive companies out there that won't do union. It's just, you know, the world is upside down sometimes. Here, let me flip this back around at you. I'll I'll be the first to acknowledge that there are hypocrites among progressives, let's say. And that we need to clean up our act internally. I had on this program, I believe it was last week, one of the people who's involved at the national level with the AFL-CIO in establishing policy, trade policy, and international policy.
Yes.
And I asked her, you know, why don't we go back to a tariff system? I went to the question of why do you support multilateral trade agreements, you know, GATT, NAFTA, CAFTA, if they have labor provisions in them. You know, why not simply say, we don't want any of these so-called free trade agreements. We want to go back to a tariff system and start protecting the workers in the United States. And her response basically was kind of a non-response of, well, we think that workers in every country have the right to be represented by unions, which I agree with. But I'm concerned that at the national level, the AFL-CIO, and which used to be the American Federation of Labor, you'll recall, and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, that many of the national unions are taking positions in favor of free trade agreements if they have labor protections in them, simply because they want to grow their membership outside the United States. Am I wrong?
I haven't seen any evidence that they want to grow their membership outside the United States.
Well, they're organizing in other countries.
This is a marginal activity. I don't think this is going to be that.
Then why would they be saying that we should have trade agreements that protect labor instead of saying we should go back to a tariff policy like we had in the United States from 1787 until Bill Clinton took it apart in 1996?
Well,
it built this country.
That's a very good question, and I'm sorry that your previous guest didn't answer it. She's director of policy. I personally don't know the answer. I suspect it's more a tactical maneuver than it is a principled one. That, in fact, the steamroller for international agreements is so powerful that what labor is holding out for is these particular.
But that's what they used to say about slavery. You know, you can never stop slavery, so why try?
Absolutely right.
You know, that's what they used to say about unions. You know, you can never stop the robber barons, so why try? You know, why form a union?
Well,
I'm sorry, Alex or Alec, that's not an answer that I'll take. You lose.
All right. Well, here's what you're going to have to do, Tom, is give me a week to research this and come back with a really glib answer for you.
Well, I'd like to know.
I'd
like to know a really honest answer, Alec. I really would like to know why the labor unions are not out there leading the cause. I had lunch with the president of a state labor union a couple days ago and, was talking about this. I just think that there's a broad, you know, a lot of folks just don't realize that this country was built on tariffs, that the salary of the President of the United States and the entire Army was paid for from the founding of this country up until the Civil War with tariffs. I mean, that's how vital it was. Anyhow, Alec Dubrow, ILCA, online, online.org, the website. Alec, thanks for being with us today.
Take care, Tom.
You too. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The ghost of Columbus haunts this world. Starts still conquering America. The meek won't survive, inherit the earth. Cause you're still conquering America.
You tell him, Tracy. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Alexander Goldmark struggling to wake up in New York City. David Poole here with me in Portland, Oregon. Dan answering the phones. Our telephone number 1-866-440-8466. And Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service is with us from the deep in the belly of the beast, Washington D.C. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you. I am absolutely in the belly of the beast today, which is the Supreme Court, which is ground zero for the first abortion case in 5 years, Ayotte v. Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. I just left the argument and the steps of the Supreme Court, where we heard the argument in this case, which will actually, it's about a New Hampshire state act called the New Hampshire Parental Notification Prior to Abortion Act.
Right. Greg, did you know that Ellen is calling us also?
I do. Ellen wanted me to be on with you today.
Well, we've got you both on. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Hi. So Greg is going to do a little Supreme Court, and I'm going to do a little White House.
Cool. Okay. Greg, finish up.
Yeah, so I was just telling Tom about the Parental Notification Prior to Abortion Act in New Hampshire. This is an act or a statute passed by the New Hampshire State Legislature that says that if you are a teenager underage and in the care of your parents, you have to notify them unless you go to the doctor and there is a death, you know, a chance that you will die if you do not have an abortion. What this case hinges on is that what if you have a health emergency and there is no health emergency clause written into this statute? And what Planned Parenthood did in this case through the lower court and through the First Circuit Court of New England, is get the entire New Hampshire statute thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore,
how is John Roberts' demeanor in the arguments today? Usually they kind of give away, they tip their hands usually in the kind of questions that they ask.
Well, that's a very interesting question because John Roberts came down on the side of the government of New Hampshire. He asked questions about, look, aren't there New Hampshire state laws that you know imply if a doctor is to perform an abortion in a medical emergency, aren't there New Hampshire state laws that will protect him? And the Attorney General of New Hampshire said that there are. And so John Roberts was playing his hand, saying that this, you know, the statute as it exists does not need a medical
waiver.
Does not need a medical emergency statute.
Yeah.
Because it's already implied in the law. However, what's interesting, Tom, is Justice Kennedy, who, if you think about it, if the new Supreme Court Justice, Sam Alito, is named before this case is voted on, he will get a vote in this case. If he comes down on the side of John Roberts, which we all expect, and, you know, on the conservatives, that will mean Justice Kennedy could be the swing vote in this case. He asked questions on both sides. He asked questions of both sides. One which was, you know, how will, you know, I want to make sure that a physician is protected in that.
And Kennedy's also Catholic, although unlike Scalia and Thomas, he's not a member of Opus Dei. Fascinating, Greg Gorman. Ellen Ratner, what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, of course, the president made his big speech today on Iraq, and in the gaggle this morning, I would say, I lost count how many times Scott McClellan was going on the word victory, victory, victory. Now, there are some people, Ellen Thomas, and she reads that we're going to declare victory and act. I actually read it very differently. I think despite the fact that he's getting Pentagon information, et cetera, that he is in fact going to stay the course, and in fact they're going to increase the number of troops there before the election. One other interesting thing, in the speech today, which was given at the Naval Academy, he invoked Senator Lieberman.
Sure.
And said, even Senator Lieberman doesn't say that we should. We didn't say even, but he basically said, Senator Lieberman does not think that we should give a date certain to get out.
Right.
And then they released a 38-page document, which as far as I can read it, and I've read through the whole thing several times, it's called Victory in Iraq. And as far as I can see, there is absolutely nothing new under the sun in the entire thing except how they have made such successes in terms of reconstruction, security, et cetera.
Yeah. Ellen, do you recall who it was who advised Richard Nixon that he should simply declare victory and get out of Vietnam?
I do not remember.
I've got to find that quote because probably somebody in our chat room will know and will let me know. But that's what I think Bush is about to do. I mean, time will tell, but it certainly seems that way.
You know something? This may seem very trite, but Mrs. Bush today unveiled the Christmas decoration. She did not take any questions. The first time I've seen a first lady not take the questions, even including the year that Clinton's head was in a vise with Monica. And secondly, usually they have decorations from all over the United States. Various artisans or local school children make decorations.
Right.
This year, none of that.
Oh, interesting. I wonder why.
Well, I guess a little bit of the Imperial White House again.
Let them eat cake. We don't have to worry about the little people, that kind of stuff.
You know, that's really been the beauty of these sort of White House Christmas decorations all these years, is that they really draw on artisans from all over the country.
Right, right. And maybe artisan is the functional word there, just like she had to cancel her poets thing. You know, artisans tend to be a little liberal sometimes. Greg Gorman and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you both. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
We live in the land of plenty, but many things aren't plenty anymore. Like the water from our sink, they say it's not safe to drink. You gotta go and buy it at the store. Now we're told there's a hole in the ozone. Look what's washing on the beach. And Lord, I believe from the heavens to the sea, we're bringing Mother Nature to her knees. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground.
Indeed.
It's only ours to borrow. Let's save some for tomorrow. Leave it and pass it on down.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman program. Some of the things George W. Bush left out of his speech today, approximately 100 attacks a day. We're at an all-time high right now in Iraq. He's talking about how wonderful things are. Yeah, it's wonderful if you're an insurgent, I guess. Although, frankly, I suspect that they would just as soon not be insurgents. They would very much like us to leave so they can get back to running their country. And one of the biggest problems that we have in Iraq is the fact that we have taken over, we've tried to privatize all their state industries and just toss them into multinational hands. Americans came in, buying up companies, buying up resources, and then when it got dangerous, just saying, okay, we're doing nothing. We're not hiring Iraqis. We're bringing in labor from outside the country because it's cheaper. It's just the neocon, the conservative economic vision of Iraq, which has been imposed on that country by and large by Paul Bremer and his rewriting of the Iraqi constitution, is decimating that country. And, you know, surprise, surprise, the people are fighting back. No country wants to be the property or to be the extractive ground, the mine for some other country. No country wants to see their wealth going to another country. And, the things that George Bush didn't share with us, he didn't go back over, his previous, many previous comments.
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups. The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations.
No, actually, they had complied with all of them except for the terrorist groups part, and that was that they were giving money to suicide bombers in Israel, and they're one of several countries in the Middle East doing that. Shall we bomb them all?
It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons.
No, sorry, not the case. But it got us into war. And then, of course, you've got to tie it into 9/11, as Bush did 27 seconds into his speech this morning, and just as he did back in 2002 when he was trying to whip up a war frenzy as like this.
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
And those threats, George, what were they?
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone. because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
Somehow he didn't reference this speech very much this morning. Those dangers?
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
Well, actually, if we waited another few weeks for the weapons inspectors, we wouldn't have over 2,000 dead American soldiers. We wouldn't have over 1,700 wounded American soldiers. We wouldn't have as many as 100,000 dead Iraqis. We wouldn't have suicide bombers going into Jordan because this woman said that three of her brothers were killed in Fallujah. We wouldn't have the world looking at us in horror saying, phosphorus bombs, torture. But Bush couldn't.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions.
And now we know that at the time George Bush said this, he knew it was not true.
We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents.
Back in the 1980s, 70s, and 80s, when they were our ally, and Don Rumsfeld was over there selling it to them, and your daddy.
Including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
Yeah, that a long time ago. But all that stuff is gone now, George. Didn't you know?
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles.
Now, these were the, this was the big 12-foot wingspan, I guess, balsa wood airplane that was Uday's toy that he could fly in the little model airplane place. They actually had a photo of this and said, this is it.
It could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Oh, they're going to target the United States with a balsa wood model airplane. I'm really worried.
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons.
And once again, we now know that at the time George Bush made this speech, he knew that his own State Department and his own Department of Energy, which is the government agency that makes bombs, told him those aluminum tubes cannot be used for centrifuges. They are for rockets, which Saddam had legally, which is what Saddam was saying they were for. By the way.
If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
Yeah, and that is true of every regime on Earth, presumably, if they could buy, steal, or so what? I mean, it wasn't happening.
We've experienced the horror of September the 11th.
Oh, there we go again.
We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people.
And now we've gone from just hating America to being hating humanity, wars on humanity, right?
Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon.
And so now, George, let's give them the grand finale. Just scare the bejesus out of them totally.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Now, somehow in George's speech this morning, none of those previous points got mentioned. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Larry in Seattle, you know who said that, I believe it was Nixon, maybe it was LBJ, should declare victory in Vietnam and go home?
Yes, Tom, that was Senator George Aiken. He was from Vermont, and that was back in October the 19th, 1966, that he wrote a analysis called Vietnam Analysis, Present and Future. And
1966?
1966.
Wow, that was when we were still basically advisors, wasn't it?
He said, considering the fact that as every day goes by, the integrity and invincibility of the United States Armed Forces is further placed in question because there is no military objective, the United States faces only two choices. Either we can attempt to escape our predicament by escalating the war into a new dimension where a new so-called aggressor is brought into play, or we can de-escalate the war on the ground that the clear and present danger of a military defeat no longer exists, and therefore de-escalation is necessary in order to avoid any danger of placing U.S. armed forces in a position of compromise. Faced with these alternatives, the United States could well declare unilaterally that this stage of the Vietnam War is over, that we have won in the sense that our armed forces are in control of most of the field, and no potential enemy is in a position to establish its authority over South Vietnam.
Amazing. Declare victory and come home. Senator George Aiken, 1966. Remarkable. Larry, thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us.
You're quite welcome.
I truly appreciate it. I got to tell you, we have the smartest listeners to this program of any talk radio program on earth. I am just continuously amazed and impressed by it. And 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, your radio show is the most incredible on the face of the earth.
Well, thank you.
I listen to it every day. Yeah, so, you know, with those clips that you were sharing with us, I mean, this shows what a despotic political regimes and vote fraud, this is the result. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You have someone like Bush, you know, as the front man for a very extremely secretive cabal, lying, you know, exploiting fears, you know, perpetuating financial wars, you know, anything, that they'll say anything to stay in power. You know, so with this upcoming State of the Union address, we should just completely rub it in his face, the lies, you know, that he's told during that particular State of the Union address, you know, lying about Iraq's, you know, supposed threat, you know, Gina.
Oh, yeah, on and on and on. And in fact, a great piece in the L.A. Times a couple of days ago about the political timing of this. I wrote a piece for Common Dreams back in October of 2002 saying essentially that the reason that Bush was trotting this war out in October of 2002 was because the midterm elections were coming in November. And, you know, everybody was like, oh, you're some kind of conspiracy nut. No, that's what they did. I mean, they took apart, you know, a whole bunch of incumbent Democrats and beat a few of them, you know.
Oh, Tom, he is toast. He and the Republicans are toast.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, David. Thank you very much for the call. Good
Bye.
To hear from you. I appreciate it. We'll see. We'll see. We all have a lot of work to do. We have a long way to go before we sleep. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yeah, it seems like. Yeah, it feels like. Yeah, it seems like.
How are you telling Van Morrison?
Yeah, it feels like. A brand new day.
I'm telling you, November 2006, November 2008, it is going to be a brand new day here in the United States of America and all over the world, because for better or for worse, to a large extent, the way America goes, so much of the rest of the world goes. Although I have to say, our influence is waning rapidly. We now have countries, European countries, allies, countries that fought side by side with us, countries that we liberated in the case of World War II. Now looking at us going, you know, we would like to subpoena 22 of your CIA officers, please, send them over here. We would like to speak with them. We're thinking, you know, in Germany, charges against Don Rumsfeld for war crimes. Crystal Myers, 17-year-old, journalism class in high school. Crystal Myers, in Oak Ridge High School in Tennessee, comes back to her senior year. Three of her classmates are pregnant. She says, somebody's got to do something about this. These kids are having sex, and they don't know how to prevent pregnancy. Or they don't know how to you know, fend off or whatever, you know, how to appropriately respond to sexual advances. So she writes an article about birth control and in the school paper. The school officials confiscate all 1,800 copies on the recommendation of the principal, a woman by the name of Becky Irvin. Superintendent Tom Bailey says the papers were seized because of the article on birth control, as well as a two-page feature about tattoos and body piercing. Yeah, right. The tattoos and body piercing, I'm sure, was you know, very offensive to them. The seizure has caught the attention of a number of First Amendment specialists, including the Student Press Law Center in Arlington, Virginia, which is advising the Oak Leaf staffers. Ms. Myers said, Crystal Myers, who wrote the article, she said, people need to know we're being censored, and that's not right. You got right-wingers foaming at the mouth saying, how dare the student newspaper talk about birth control? Was this Opus Dei or something? I mean, bottom line for me, if a human being is old enough to engage in sexual activity, then they damn well better know what the consequences of it are and you know, how to appropriately avoid disease in pregnancy. And they should have, frankly, in my opinion, they should also have some instruction in the social consequences of sexual activity. You know, that is to say, you know, there is a downside to promiscuity, and particularly to early promiscuity. It should be included. You know, I remember, here I am doing this old fart thing. You know, I remember 30 years ago or more when I was in junior high school, in what, 7th, 8th grade, the gym teacher doing the obligatory sex ed class where he told us that if we masturbated, we'd end up in Jackson Prison. I kid you not, he actually told us that. It was a little weird, you know, sex ed back in the 60s, but still, it was there. And there's a lot of schools now where it's just not even there. The Oak Leaf's editor, Brittany Thomas, said the objections to Myers' article amounted to a concern over explicit language describing two forms of birth control most commonly practiced among students, condoms and withdrawal, as well as information on contraception, which Tennessee law allows students to get without notifying parents. Bailey said, we have the responsibility of the public to do the right thing. We got 14-year-olds who read that newspaper. I'd say all the more reason that that article should be in the newspaper if there are 14-year-olds who are reading it. If there are 14-year-olds who were getting married in the United States 100 years ago. Well, you, Jerry Lee Lewis. Yeah, let's not go there. Anyhow, but Myers said, kids use worse language, and I use medical language, and quoted a doctor. If this man has a PhD and knows what he's talking about, why can't it be in there? This is the Becky Myers, the woman who, or Crystal Myers, rather, the young lady, 17 years old, the young woman who wrote the article. In fact, she says the students not mature enough to read the text are the ones who need it. And, you know, I strongly agree with that. Bailey's office refused to comment to ABC News, promising a statement today. Thomas accused school officials of constantly changing their story, and they won't put it in writing for me. I'm telling you, this is, and the right-wingers are going to just be going nuts with this thing. How, you know, how dare they talk about sex education to teenagers? Thomas is negotiating with school officials to release the paper. She says it needs to go out as soon as possible because it includes advertisements with dated coupons. She's agreed to say that the student owners of the tattoos displayed in the article would remain nameless. You know, like that's the big issue, right? Cynthia Dillard of the Alan Gottmacher Institute, a nonprofit for sexual and reproductive health, says when it comes to sex education, freedom of the press should be absolute. Amen. There's no evidence denying kids about sex or contraception is in any way protective. And in fact, all the studies indicate that kids who don't know about sex education are more likely to get diseases or get pregnant. Jimmy in Vancouver, BC, we have just a minute left. Jimmy, what's up?
Hey, to comment on what you're talking about, man, I'm actually from Fairfax, Virginia, and I'm up in BC right now. And it's pretty much the same thing, man. You know, like I grew up with a bunch of teenagers. You know, we all didn't know a hole in the ground for my butt. So, and, you know, a lot of us didn't have our parents around. And, you know, when you're in school, you're there for an education. That includes all aspects, which also includes sex ed. And, you know, a lot of us wound up with STDs, kids out the yin-yang. Like, I got 5 kids now. Not that, you know, I don't take care of them. But the point is, you know, that's what the schools are there for. They're there to teach us, and you know, when they're
absolutely
shutting
agree
us
with
down
you,
and not teaching us, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And, in fact, the school's not just there to teach us, but to teach life skills. The fact that kids can graduate from high school in the United States and not know how to balance a checkbook, not know how to change a diaper, not know how to raise a child, not know how to negotiate to buy a house, not understand how mortgages work, not know about sex education is, to me, mind-boggling. I mean, this is just like basic stuff that has to do with life skills, functional life skills, how to protect yourself, how to keep yourself alive, and how to function in this world. And, you know, but, you know, where are our priorities? Well, you know, we've got to teach to the test for the No Child Left Behind, so we don't have time to talk about how to balance a checkbook. And besides that, we don't want people knowing how to balance checkbooks. We want them bouncing checks, because then the banks can charge them fees and make a whole lot more money off them, didn't you know? And, of course, sex ed, you just, you know, just stir up all the crazies. Amazing. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here on the True People's Radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Welcome to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Investment or expense? The conservatives would have you think that any kind of social programs are expenses. And without looking down the road at what the consequences may be, it's really important, I think, that we start reframing the conversation in the context of investment, the way that we traditionally looked at these things in the United States, literally from the founding of this country. Ron Herndon is with us with SaveHeadStart.org. And Ron, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Great. Glad to have you here. You're the chairman of the board of the National Head Start Association, SaveHeadStart.org. And the White House is dismantling Head Start?
It certainly has tried to do that ever since Mr. Bush was elected president. It came forward with plans to send Head Start dollars to the states so they could use them anywhere they wanted to without having to conform with National Head Start regulations or performance standards. But Head Start parents and supporters rallied and prevented that from happening. And this time, what's surprising to us, this is the year that Head Start legislation is up for reauthorization. What's really surprising is both the leadership of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have agreed upon changes to Head Start that if that legislation is passed in the Senate, it will dismantle Head Start.
Now, we know that the investment in Head Start yields substantial returns down the road in terms of reduced crime, reduced expenses associated with that, detention of people, court system costs, increases in the tax base, more people participating in the economy. Can you quantify that? Do you have those numbers at your fingertip there, Ron Herndon?
Sure. There has been research done. Probably the one regarding numbers is a gentleman, Dr. Meyer, in California. And his numbers suggested that for every dollar you invest in Head Start, society gets $9 back.
Over the course of the lifetime of that child who participated in Head Start.
Oh, yes. So they're far more likely to graduate from high school. The children, which doesn't get talked about, they are far healthier, less likely to be retained in grade, less likely to end up in special education, as you talked about earlier, far less likely to go to college and less likely to end up in the criminal justice system. So,
more likely to go to college, you mean?
Pardon me?
More likely to go to college if they go
to college.
Yes, I'm
sorry. Yeah. More likely to go to college.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry I interrupted you. You were
no, I was saying that the people who follow Head Start, they are very aware of those statistics, which makes it all the more baffling why the leadership of both parties are contemplating these changes that will destroy the program.
Yeah, I can understand why the Republicans would, because there's this core belief in the Republican Party and this basic conservative belief that goes back all the way to when the Republican Party stopped being essentially a progressive party in the 1870s and became the party of big business, that government should be as small as possible so that the commons and so that all the community things that we do together can be handled by corporations at a profit. That's their primary core belief. Make government smaller so you can make corporations bigger and they can have more power over our lives. But I don't understand why the Democratic Party, why people in the Democratic Party would be in favor of the Trojan horse that you say is in the Head Start reauthorization bill. Hasn't anybody, you guys, I mean, you're the National Head Start Association, have you sat down with Harry Reid and said, Harry, let's talk about this?
We've talked with all of the members of the leadership of the Democratic Party in both the House committee that was responsible for Head Start legislation. That was George Miller, who was a ranking Democratic member, to no avail. We've spoken with Senator Kennedy's office, who is the ranking member of the Democratic leadership in the Senate committee that's responsible for Head Start legislation to no avail. And, Tom, throughout Head Start's history, for the most part, we've received bipartisan support, but there have been these times when both Republicans and Democrats have attempted to make harmful changes to Head Start. Jimmy Carter, when he was president, he wanted to send Head Start to the Department of Education, but Head Start parents rallied and prevented that from happening. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if you go back to the inception of Head Start and some of the other war on poverty programs, Sergeant Shriver had a meeting with a lot of big city mayors, most of whom were Democratic, and they let him know in no uncertain terms they were opposed to these programs because the money and the decision-making would go directly to communities. So both parties, there have been instances in which they have proposed changes that would have been harmful to Head Start, and we just don't understand why now the Democrats, Senator Kennedy, Senator Clinton is on that committee in the Senate, and as well as Senator Dodd, why they would agree to changes that would reduce parents from being decision makers in Head Start to just giving advice. Decisions that they've made that would insist on Head Start teachers having BAs, but not paying them to go to school to get them, or giving programs the money to raise their salaries. Mm-hmm. If in fact they are able to get these BAs, I mean, we don't understand it.
Yeah, and the bottom line is, if you have programs that do have local control,
yep,
you're going to have local support.
Absolutely. And parents have been a part of a checks and balances system in Head Start. I mean, they are decision makers along with local boards. Why the Democrats would agree with reducing parents to just giving advice, we don't know. And in the House, which we couldn't understand with Mr. Miller, there's a provision that said that if you're a member of a Head Start board, you can only serve for 5 years, term limits. Well, my goodness, they don't give term limits to themselves as members of the House of Representatives. Why would you impose that on a local board? But they agree to that.
Yeah, we're talking with Ron Herndon, the chairman of the National Board of the Head Start Association. Their website, www.saveheadstart.org. And on that website, people can take action. They can use your website to directly contact their members of Congress. I would also add that if people want to call their member of Congress, the straight number right into the main switchboard in Washington, D.C., and you can simply, if you don't know who represents you in the House of Representatives, give them your zip code. They will tell you, and they will connect you. If you don't know who your senators are in your state, tell them the name of your state. They will tell you. You can ask for either one. Ultimately, I suggest you ask for both of your senators. That number is 202-225-3121. That's the main Capitol Hill switchboard. And if you want to call toll-free, you can call 888-355-3121. 3588, 888-355-3588, or you can go to saveheadstart.org and do it by email. Ron Herndon, chairman of the board of the National Head Start Association, what excuse do they give you? I mean, they have to say something.
Well, it's been pretty pitiful. What you get is, this is the best that we could do, and we've been asked the question, who is we? And sometimes it's better to say no than to accept a compromise that is going to fundamentally change a very good organization, an institution that has functioned well for 40 years.
So you're saying folks like Ted Kennedy and Hillary Clinton are saying to you, sorry,
staff,
it's just a political reality.
Yeah, this is what their staff people have told us. As a matter of fact, Tom, they told us 3 years ago when the reauthorization process was underway, essentially the exact same thing. And then they said, well, you better accept this deal because if George Bush is reelected president, you will see some legislation that will be even worse. And we said, no, we're not accepting this. This, what you're doing will destroy Head Start, and we're not going to accept some political compromise that you put forward for reasons we can't understand. We would rather fight than accept this. And this is our position now. And our board has said the exact same thing. And it's really been very disappointing, Tom, to hear what we've gotten from the leadership of the Senate Democratic Party as well as the House.
Ron Herndon, do you have any champions in the House or the Senate?
We were very, very pleased. Representative Maxine Waters and Loretta Sanchez took on the leadership of the Democratic Party. They're both Democrats from California, and they fought to get an amendment passed that would have restored the role of parents in decision-making in Head Start. And surprisingly, a representative, Republican, conservative representative, Souter from Indiana, he listened to Head Start parents. He proposed an amendment in the House that would have restored voting for parents in Head Start.
Mm-hmm.
He bucked his own leadership in the House and in the White House. And it got to be so sorry that, as from what Representative Souter told us,
as people were beginning to see why they should change their votes and vote for this amendment, that the leadership, the House leadership in that committee, locked the doors so that House of Representative members could not come back in and change their vote.
Physically locked the doors.
Hello?
Physically locked the doors, right?
Yeah, physically said, oh, no, the vote's over, you can't come back and change your vote.
Absolutely.
That's the
amazing
leadership of both parties.
Yeah. So, Ron Herndon, when people go to SaveHeadStart.org or when they call 202-225-3121 or toll-free 888-355-3588 and talk to their member of Congress, what specifically should they say?
One, just retain the current language in law that allows parents, Head Start parents, to remain as decision makers in Head Start. They have the power to approve or disapprove major decisions. And don't tinker around with that. Two, do not insist on teachers obtaining BAs unless you pay for it.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you very much. And you can learn the whole story at SaveHeadStart.org. Ron Herndon, thanks so much for being with us
today.
Thanks,
Tom.
Much appreciated. Keep up the great work, sir. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. What an idea!
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
Still trying to save my soul, they tell me. We now saw, counts all those material things you gain by.
Ein Papier, bitte. I gotta tell you, I remember back 1986. Louise and I and our three kids were living in Germany, and we took a train. Frankly, I don't remember where we took it to. I believe, oh, wait a minute, it was up to Poland and to Warsaw, and then we took a train up the Baltic states through Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and then the ferry over to Finland, and which is where our daughter was staying, and we were living down south in Germany. And we had to travel through, I believe it was Belarus. And as we got, we were just on this train, right? And we hit the border of the country, and the train stops, and these guys get on with machine guns over their shoulders and German Shepherd dogs, and they're all dressed in these green uniforms with the red stars on their caps and the whole nine yards. And a guy comes up to me, and I'm sitting here with my wife and two of my kids, and his gun is pointed at me. I mean, it's not like his hand's on the trigger or anything, but it's just kind of resting in my direction in general. And he says, Ihren Papier, bitte. Your papers, please. And I had to present my passport and that of my family. That's life. That was life in the Soviet Union. That's a recent example. Earlier than that, back in the early 80s, I'd been in the actual Soviet Union. Later in the 90s, I was in Kaliningrad. I wrote about it in a book called The Prophet's Way. My oldest daughter and I visited East Berlin when we lived in Germany. And wherever you go, you got to present your papers. If you check into a hotel, you've got to leave your passport with them overnight. It's just, you know, Papier bitte. Well, Deborah Davis is discovering that things are changing in the United States. This an article by David Harsanyi in the Denver Post. He says, Deborah Davis doesn't consider herself a hero, certainly not a modern-day champion of the Constitution, yet in her own way she might be a bit of both. 2 months ago, this 50-year-old mother of four was reading a book while riding to work on RTD's Route 100. Now, RTD, this is the, I don't know what the acronym stands for, but it's the public bus system in Colorado. This public bus, the public bus, happens to go through the Denver Federal Center. It's like a shortcut. It goes across federal property. And some people who work there at the Denver Federal Center get off inside the property and, you know, to go to work. So the first time she's taking this bus, to work. She's trying to save some money and, not pollute the environment, whatever. First time she's on the bus, they pull into the Denver Federal Center. And a guy gets on the bus, guard gets on the bus, gun, uniform, walks up to her and says, "Your papers, please. Your identification." She said, "If I had my ID, I'm not going to show it to you." Well, that, you know, first time he said, he argued with her a little bit and then left. But the next time, she says, "I told him that I did have identification, but I wasn't going to show it to him. I knew that I wasn't required by law to show ID, and that's why I decided I wasn't going to. The whole thing seemed to be more about compliance than security." We're talking police state here. According to Davis, the guard proceeded to call on federal cops, who then dragged Davis off a public bus, handcuffed her, shoved her into the back seat of a police car, and drove off to a police station within the federal center. Her middle son is risking his life in Iraq while the federal government that George W. Bush this morning told us is killing people in Iraq for liberty in the United States, while his mother is being arrested for not showing her papers on a public bus. She's scheduled to be arraigned on December 9th, could face up to 60 days in jail. The ACLU is going to take this on. I'm sure that this will make all the right-wingers foam at the mouth. Good on you, ACLU. I mean, this is just wrong. As Gail Johnson, a volunteer ACLU lawyer, says, she was a passenger on a public bus. She got on the bus outside of the federal area, and she wanted to get off the bus outside the federal area. It's not her fault that the bus runs along this route. Now, this is just very straightforward stuff. Davis says, there's nothing far out about me. I've been laid off. I pay my taxes. I have my problems. I'm no different than anyone else. It just didn't seem right. I'm a regular, normal, everyday person. Ah, but she's wrong. That's the Denver Post. She's not like anyone else. She stood up to the growing police power in this state and said, "No, you can't do this. The Fourth Amendment says I have the right of privacy. I have the right to be secure in my person and papers. I don't have to show you my papers simply because I'm on a public street." Now, you can argue if somebody's driving a car, that's a function that we license, and appropriately so. Or if somebody's walking with a gun in areas where there's gun control, that's a function that we license. But simply walking in public or riding on public transportation, you have to show your papers? I don't think so. We have not become Belarus. Or have we? This is something, frankly, I think we all should be paying a lot of attention to, and I hope the mainstream media picks this thing up in a big way. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, can't get fooled again.
You're right.
People think I'm a moron. What if they only knew the depth of my evil genius? And I can be stupid whenever I need to, yeah. In my midnight confessions, I reveal my imperial secrets. I'm the master of misdirection, with a few intellectual defects. There's a little button I keep in my hand. You better understand.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. Now, here's an interesting juxtaposition. Kurt Anderson is an Associated Press writer, and yesterday he wrote an article, actually day before yesterday, November 28th, but it was widely distributed yesterday. He wrote an article, Dateline Miami. The first three sentences, Miami police announced Monday they will stage random shows of force at hotels, banks, and other public places to keep terrorists guessing and remind people to be vigilant. Deputy Police Chief Frank Fernandez said officers might, for example, surround a bank building, check the IDs of everyone going in and out, and hand out leaflets about terror threats. It's an in-your-face type of strategy, Fernandez said. It's letting the terrorists know that we're out there. Okay, so the article published, written on the 28th, published on the 28th and 29th of November by Kurt Anderson of the Associated Press, says that the police in Miami are going to be checking IDs. The next day, without any reference to the previous article, Tuesday, November 29th, Kurt Anderson of the Associated Press writes an article with a slightly different spin to it. Let me show the first four paragraphs here. Police are planning in-your-face shows of force in public places, saying the random high-profile security operations will keep terrorists guessing about where officers might be next. As an example, uniformed and plainclothes officers might surround a bank building unannounced, contact the manager about ways to be vigilant against terrorists, and hand out leaflets in three languages to customers and people passing by, said police spokesman Angel Calzadilla. He said there would be no random checks of identification. No random checks of identification. Deputy Police Chief Frank Fernandez said Monday, people are definitely going to notice it. We want that shock. We want that awe. But at the same time, we don't want people to feel their rights are being threatened. We need them to be our eyes and ears. Howard Simon, Executive Director of ACLU of Florida, said the Miami initiative appears aimed at ensuring that people's rights are not violated. Simon said, this is the executive director of Florida's ACLU. He said, what we're dealing with is officers on street patrol making informed decisions on which individuals to stop, which is more effective and more consistent with the Constitution. We'll have to see how it's implemented. He said that one example of a legitimate stop might be an officer questioning a person entering a crowd while wearing a heavy coat on a summer day. Yeah, in other words, suspicious activity. The operations will keep terrorists off guard, Fernandez said. He said Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups plot attacks by putting places under surveillance and watching for flaws and patterns in security. So what they're going to do is they're going to disrupt the patterns. They're going to be random. Both uniformed plainclothes officers riding buses and trains, others conducting long-term surveillance operations. But once again, they're not going to be checking ID, says the article written on the 29th, whereas the article written on the 28th by the same writer, Kurt Anderson, says that they will be checking ID. No retraction, simply a new article. Color me baffled. I am guessing that the guy wrote wrong and got slammed and fixed it. But, you know, we'll see. I don't know. 1-866-440-THOM, our number, 440-8466. Brian in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, that's kind of strange because that's the exact article that I was calling about, the one that he wrote on the 28th. And then the quotes that you were pulling from the one on the 29th are the exact quotes that he wrote in the one on the 28th about the shock and all, but we still want people to, you know, not feel their rights have been threatened. So, I mean, I don't understand why he would have done that, wrote one article and then not have any retraction or anything to say that, oh, yeah, I wrote this one yesterday, but here this one is. It's kind of strange.
Yeah, it is. It comes right out. He said there will be no random checks of identification, which is like, I mean, that's the giant red flag. That's the smoking stick of dynamite in the story. And in the first article, in the first story, it's a single sentence. It's not even a single sentence. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 words in a sentence.
Right.
You know, check the IDs of everyone going in and out. And here in the second story, it's just this one standalone sentence it's not standalone, it's the last sentence of the second paragraph. He said there would be no random checks of identification. Just, you know, kind of slide on by. Interesting. So
I wonder how many people will be like that 50-year-old woman and refuse, or will just be like, oh, yeah, here's my ID, you know.
Well, apparently, you know, I'm inclined to believe that Kurt Anderson got the story wrong on the 28th and got it right on the 29th because he's quoting the director of the ACLU in Florida on the 29th saying that this is okay with us. And so I don't think that they're going to be doing random ID checks. My concern with this is that it is the beginning of the process.
Right. It's that whole the frog in the pot. If you just throw him in the boiling water, he'll jump right out. But if you slowly turn it up, he'll
there you
cooked.
Go. Yeah. This is acclimating people to cops walking around, you know, machine guns over their shoulder, walking up to people, asking them questions. I mean, having a police officer, a uniformed, armed police officer, hand you a piece of paper. Yeah, it may not seem coercive, but what, are you going to not take it?
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's like, you know, we're here, and Big Brother is watching you. And, you know, you could argue, okay, in a post 9/11 world, we do want Big Brother looking around at a certain level, but frankly, I think that we would be much better served if we were getting rid of the causes of 9/11 rather than trying to rather than trying to turn America into Belarus.
When you have 50% of New Yorkers thinking that the government had some kind of inner dealings with 9/11, then who is Big Brother and who are they watching?
So. Yeah, it gets weirder and weirder, doesn't it, Brian?
Yep.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. David in Seattle, Washington. David, your thoughts on all this?
Apropos to what you're talking about, several months ago on the Mike Malloy show, two women on two different occasions called in. They both had grown up in Germany in the early 30s, and they said the similarity to what was going on then and what is going on here in this country now is almost identical.
Oh, yeah. I go over to BuzzFlash.com, and on the home page you will see a book review that I wrote about a book called They Thought They Were Free by Milton Mayer, where in 1955 he went over to Germany and interviewed 10 Nazis and tells their story. These are people who were Nazis, who were not, you know, like fanatic true believers, joined the military, all, you know, a university professor, a baker, you know, those kinds of things. Just average people who joined the party because that's what you had to do. And you know, he tells the story of these people and their lives and how the Nazis took over Germany. And actually, I lay a lot of it out in the review. I think you'll find the review very illuminating. It's over at BuzzFlash.com.
There was an English, American woman teaching in England. Her husband was in the military. And she showed her middle grade students a movie about the rise and fall of the Third Reich. And she said the similarities between the rise of the Third Reich and what's happening in this country was so scary, she said, I don't think I'm coming back to America.
You know, the one that has me the spooked the most, David, is in the 1920s, if you go back and you read the history of Germany, and I actually wrote half a book on this. Myself and a friend of mine were going to write a book on the religion of the Nazis, how the Nazis were basically a cult, not unlike the I don't want to draw parallels, but in any case, it was basically a cult. And we spent a fair amount of time in Europe traveling around. We met with the king of one of the kingdoms in Europe, a constitutional monarchy. We met with Professor Wilfred Diam, who wrote the book Der Mann der Idee, Der Hitlergeist, you know, the man who gave Hitler the idea, a book by Georg von Fritz Liebenfels, the guy who published Ostara, which was the magazine that first laid out the Nazi agenda back in the 19-teens, and Hitler was collecting these things in the 1920s. And, you know, snuck into Wavelsburg, into this castle in Wavelsburg where Hitler was going to turn it into his Vatican and he was initiating his people and all this kind of stuff. Hitler and Hess, when they were putting together Mein Kampf, when Hitler was in jail and Hess was helping him write this thing, they were studying Zionism. There was a strong Zionist movement in Europe at the time to create a Jewish homeland. And, you know, in the Middle East. And Hitler really liked the idea of creating a racial identity for the German people. And he thought that the way to do that was to use the word homeland. The word homeland had never been used to describe Germany before. In German, the word is Heimacht. Instead, it had always been Vaterland, fatherland. And Hitler proposed, and Hess proposed that they stop using the word Vaterland and start going with Heimat, with instead of the fatherland or instead of the nation or instead of domestic security, things like that, they would refer to it as the homeland. We had and that would create a sense of racial pride among Germans. And here is Rudolf Hess first introducing the word Heimat in 1934 in Germany. At the Nuremberg rallies, the first time that this word was rolled out by the Nazis. And just listen for the word Heimat, and I'll translate as we go along.
Dank ihrer Führung.
Thanks to the Führer.
Wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen.
And now Germany is now going to be a homeland for Germans.
Heimat zu sein.
A homeland
für alle Deutschen der Welt.
For all the Germans in the world. That was the first introduction of the word homeland in Germany. And in 2001, all of a sudden, I'm hearing the word homeland here in the United States. I had never heard it before.
Well, another thing Mike Malloy read one night was the German Enabling Act.
Oh, yeah.
It's very much like our Patriot Act.
Yeah, you'll find that in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? There's an entire chapter on that.
But,
It's absolutely spooky. David, I've got to run to take a break here, but I appreciate your call and the points that you're making, and you know, well said. There are some spooky parallels. And, you know, as I said, I've said many times, the positive, the upside of this, is that we have a 200-year tradition of democracy in the United States. We're not going to go down as easily as the Germans did. They wanted a king, and they got it in Hitler. We don't want a king here. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now the thing that I call living is just being satisfied with knowing I got no one left to blame.
There you go. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, huh? Nine and a half, more or less. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news, where being progressive never felt so good. I got to tell you, it's true. Jared is on the line in New York City. Hey, Jared, welcome to the program.
Tom, how are you doing today?
I am just great, but I'll get better. How about you, Jared?
Okay. I had a thought when you were talking about police officers and identification.
Yeah, in New York, you're experiencing that in the subways right now, aren't you?
Yeah, they want to go looking in backpacks, and the ACLU has them in court, and who knows what's going to come from this.
Yeah, although they're still not asking for ID. They're just looking at backpacks.
Well, it's still it's searching a personal effect, and as I understand the Fourth Amendment, that's one reason that we revolted from England.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, personal effects is the phrase used in the Fourth Amendment.
Yes. So my thought on this is that maybe it's time for an informal Alice's Restaurant movement, in the sense that if someone is stopped by a peace officer, most or all peace officers, as far as I know, have to sign or take an oath stating they support the United States Constitution. Give them a little copy of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights and say, Officer, do you understand this? Can you support it? If you cannot, well, I'm going to have to ask you to resign or be placed under arrest because the office requires that you support it. If you don't understand what you're doing wrong, please call your supervisor and place yourself under arrest. I'm going to have to take you in.
As they mace you and knock you to the ground?
Well, these are the hazards of living in a free state.
There you go. There you go.
Obviously, there's a fine line of discretion to use, but I remember back in the 70s, there was talk about a Harvard University street study where they showed people a copy of the Constitution and said, what is it? And people said the Communist Manifesto.
Yeah, and more than half of the people who read it said that. Actually, it was a multiple-choice question, but yes, yeah.
And,
I remember that well.
Not to denigrate the many fine cops who were doing a hard job and doing it well, most of the cops are just like all the rest of us. They wouldn't know what the Constitution was if it came printed on a bag.
Yeah, yeah. Well said, Jared. Interesting. Alice's Restaurant movement. Thanks for the call.
Okay, Tom.
Great to hear from you. Tony in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good talking with you again.
Thank you.
Man, I just on my mind, yeah, definitely with the national ID goes along with the police state. That's real scary. But what I was thinking, what I was telling your call screener was, when I was listening to Bush this morning, man, if it didn't sound like someone was reading like the Bible or like.
Well, this is like, where, you know, early on in the speech, he said these people are waging a war against humanity. And that's where I started this program, you know, almost 3 hours ago, was saying, wait a minute, human beings can't wage a war against humanity. Only demonic forces can wage a war against humanity, or non-humans, because humanity is us. I mean, we don't wage war against us. And that is the language of religion. The only way that Bush could believe that somebody is waging a war against all human beings on Earth is if he believes that those people have been seized or taken over by some demonic force, that we're living in the last days, that the Antichrist is here, that kind of thing. And it absolutely spooked me when he said that. He just gave me a chill when he said that they're waging a war against humanity.
I believe most of your callers understand manifest destiny, right?
Yeah, well, and if they don't, we'll just give them a one-sentence explanation. Basically, manifest destiny was the doctrine that that what was happening because it was preordained.
God's will.
Yeah, and this was used as the rationale for killing off Native Americans all across this country and taking this land.
Do you think Bush, I know this is just an instant yes to this answer, but I mean, when you see the wife on television talking about, they haven't had it so well, and I mean,
his mother, you mean?
Aren't they like, I mean, they really do believe this is God's will.
Well, I think that there is a strong Calvinist streak, although they probably wouldn't call it that, in the Bush family, and frankly in a lot of very wealthy quote religious people,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, the notion that John Calvin had back, you know, 200-300 years ago, that wealth is the sign of the blessing of God and poverty is a sign of moral failure.
On my way out, let me just tell you this: on a rival station, I got to say that Dory Monson, he actually came out and said during the crisis of Katrina that why are we going to give these people $2,000? They're down there because of faults of their own. That's like giving an 18-year-old who should be going out to get a job, that's like giving them an allowance.
Oh yeah, Tucker Carlson on his show. I remember, you know, during this time, somebody was, you know, talking about, I think it was national health care, and he said, "Hey, listen, we all know that people who are wealthy in America have, you know, lower risks of diseases because they have better access to health care and they can take care of themselves." He says that's simply a fact of life in America. That's how it's supposed to be. Now,
yeah.
You know, I may not be quoting him verbatim, but it's awful close.
I understand. It's the same line. We're seeing this like clairvoyantly. Tom, much love to you and your show and your listeners.
Well, thank you, Tony. Thank you. I appreciate it. And thanks so much for calling. It's good to hear from you. This is just, you know, Bush's speech today, this war against humanity, this speech, as is always the case with Bubble Boy here, before a handpicked non-public audience. Nobody from the general public was allowed in unless they were handpicked by the Republican Party. He also went on to say that the foreigners are responsible for what he called the terror in Iraq. All evidence belies that it is the Iraqis themselves who are fighting against us. Instead of referring to the insurgents, he kept referring to these terrorists, trying to tie 9/11 back into it. It took him 27 seconds from the time.